Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
I want to start off by wishing you a congratulations, because you have just entered your Jubilee. Yes, this is the year of Jubilee. For those of you who might not fully understand what a Jubilee is, you are familiar that when God created the earth, he made it in 6 days, and on the seventh day he rested and gave that day as a special day to mankind. Well, when Israel came into the land of Israel, God told them that in the land they were to honour what they called a 7-year Sabbath to the land. Now, every 6 years the land would produce, but in the seventh year it wasn't to be worked, but you could eat whatever it grew on it. However, God also highlighted at this time, and this is in Leviticus 25, if any of you wish to look it up later, Leviticus 25, God also highlighted that after seven Sabbaths, a total of 49 years, the year after that would be a Jubilee. Now, why is a Jubilee important? Well, let me explain what happened in a Jubilee. All your debts got wiped out. Every commitment that you had made on behalf of yourself was cancelled. So, for example, if you had found yourself in a situation where your children had to be sold into slavery because you couldn't afford to look after them, at the Jubilee, they were returned to you. At the Jubilee, if you had been sold to sell the family plot of land because you couldn't afford to live otherwise, at the Jubilee, it was returned to you. Now, for a church, this is really our first Jubilee. And so I want to bring out the spiritual understanding of that. This Jubilee lasts and starts on the Day of Atonement. It doesn't start at the beginning of the year, which was 10 days earlier. It starts on the Day of Atonement, which was last Wednesday. I know there might be some of you who said, well, actually, William, it was Sunset Tuesday to Sunset Wednesday. But I'm talking about the day, and it was Wednesday. Okay. What does it mean to you? Well, you get a fresh start. You know that the Jubilee ultimately reflects Jesus Christ, who has freed us from all sin, who has freed us from the power of darkness and from death. That's what Jesus has done. He has freed us from our enemy. He has cancelled our debts. He has made us free and set us back into our position with God in perfect relationship. So the Jubilee always reflects Christ, and it always reflects the importance of our relationship with Jesus Christ. And that's the wonderful thing about it, that we can need to understand and appreciate. So for this year, I accept the fact that while Phoebe would be 56 when the next Jubilee happens, she might be one of the few who would be here to celebrate that one. So we have got it this time. This is our Jubilee, our opportunity to really reflect. Yes, I'm getting a sign from the back here saying, here, I'm only 20. I'll only be in the 70s. That happened, yes. Note this, 70s. Okay, but is the Jubilee what I'm going to talk to you about today? No. I have a different sermon in mind. Let me tell you what I'm going to talk to you about today. It is linked, in a sense, to the Jubilee. And I did mention it there, that in the Jubilee, through Christ, we have been freed from a terrible, terrible punishment called death. And that's what I want to talk to you about today. I want to look at the subject of the resurrection. Not Jesus' resurrection, your resurrection. That gets you worried. Yes, it's still ahead of you. But for some people, it's what they're waiting patiently to see. If we consider in the Bible, in the book of Genesis, the very first individual to have died was called Abel. He didn't die of old age. He didn't die by accident. He died because he was murdered. He has been dead and buried for nearly 6,000 years. And that's something we have to consider using the Bible chronology. 6,000 years he has been dead and buried. And yet we're told that he is righteous. He is one who will rise in the resurrection of the just and will meet Christ in the air when he returns. These are the things that we're reminded about in Scripture and through Christ. But to understand resurrection, we need to separate it from other events that happened in the Bible. Some of the other events that happened were the dead being returned to life. And this is different from a resurrection, because if you're returned to life, you still have to die. It'll happen again. Let's cover three different incidents where the dead return to life from the Old Testament. The first is in 1 Kings 17, and it's from 17 to 24, though I don't want to go into it in too much detail, so I'll just overview. Elijah had basically been told by God to pray that there would be no rain in the land. This caused a massive drought, a famine across the whole land. You could say Elijah was not exactly in the public interest, so there was a lot of people after him. But God took him and protected him for a long time and fed him with birds, and we've covered that before at other times. But when the brook that he was getting his water from dried up, God took Elijah to a lady's house. Not a Jewish lady, not an Israelite lady, a Gentile lady. This lady from Zarephath was a small town, by the way. Zarephath had a son. When Elijah arrived at her home, she was making her final meal. You see, the famine had struck her land too. So God had said, right, I'm going to get somebody to look after you. But he put them in the famine area so that it would have to be done miraculously. So this lady said, well, I only have enough meal for myself and my son, and after that, we're going to die like everybody else. But the prophet had said to her, no, think about this. Feed me first, and there will be enough oil in your jar and meal in your bin to feed you and your son thereafter. And it did. She did that. She accepted his word. She fed him her meal. She put it on the plate in front of him, and she then went and she made more food for herself and her son. The little bit of oil was there for to do it. The little bit of grain was still there. And the next day when Elijah wanted to get fed, she went back to her bin, and the same amount of grain was there and the same amount of oil. And after she had fed him, she went back and she took another and fed her and her son. And this continued for all the time of the famine, without exception. So this lady realized that this was indeed a servant of God. And the promise for her that was given to her in order for her service to God in looking after the prophet, the promise was that she and her son would live. She and her son would live. So you can imagine her distress in verse 17 of 1 Kings 17. When it came to pass after these things that the son of the woman, the mistress of the house, fell sick. And his sickness was so sore that there was no breath left in him. And she said unto Elijah, what have I to do with thee, O man of God? Art thou come unto me to call my sins to remembrance and to slay my son? She was a bit annoyed. I think we understand that, especially the ladies among us. If you lose your child, your only son, you had been given a promise that he would be protected. You weren't worried too much about yourself, but he was going to be protected. And he's the one that died. When you're caring for this prophet, when you're meeting his needs, when you're feeding him out of your bread bin, your thing of oil. Even though God is keeping it going miraculously, you've just lost your son. So she comes to the prophet, and his response to her is, give me your son. He took him out of her bosom, carried him up into the loft where he abode, and he laid him upon his own bread. And he cried out unto the Lord and said, O Lord my God, thou hast also brought evil unto this widow with whom I sojourn by slaying her son. And he stretched himself out upon the child 3 times and cried unto the Lord and said, O Lord my God, I pray thee, let this child's soul come back into him again. And the Lord heard the voice of Elijah, and the soul of the child came into him again, and he revived. And Elijah took the child, brought him down out of the chamber into the house, and delivered him unto his mother. And Elijah said, See, thy son liveth. And the woman said to Elijah, By this I know that thou art a man of God, and that the words of the Lord are in thy mouth is truth. That last statement tells us why her son died. I know it's strange that we would have to understand this. But you see, God needed this lady to understand that he was the true God of creation. That he was the one who truly is, and that he determines life and death. This woman and her son were destined to die in a famine. This woman and her son would not have survived more than a few days, maybe a few weeks, after they had run out of food. It would have been a slow, painful death, and there was nothing she could have done about it. But through God's providence, she was given life, and that life was extended through her actions to her child. Today we often forget that that's something that we also have. Our actions reflect to our children. You say, well, does that mean God accepts them as holy because he's made us holy? He does within marriage, but that's not what I'm getting at. If you obey God, if you follow God, if you do what God expects of you, you set a perfect example to your children and to your grandchildren. They learn from that example. And that means that in truth, you are giving them the opportunity to live. Because by learning from you, they can know God. And by knowing God, they inherit eternal life. That's something we need to know. That's what God needed this lady to understand. And she got her son back, and she knew the prophet was telling her the truth. You might think that that was an unusual type of miracle. Yet the prophet who replaced Elijah is called Elisha. Elisha asked for a rather unusual thing. He asked for a double portion of Elijah's spirit, or his power and authority, if you prefer. And it was granted to him. So when we find that Elisha, their names are very similar, excuse me if I mix them up, Elisha had a habit of walking between certain areas in the country, and he followed a particular road. He'd come across a house of a Shunammite. Now the Shunammite lady of the house had watched the prophet many times. She had invited him in, made him a meal, and allowed him to spend the night in their home. And she thought to herself, this man is regularly making this journey to and from across the country. We're quite well off. We could build a little house inside of our property so that he could stay and have a bit of peace and quiet by himself when he comes here. It was a very generous thought. She didn't go ahead and just do it. She talked it over with her husband, and she pointed out to her husband that this would be a great thing to do. When he agreed, then it was done. Elisha was really touched. This was a kindness he couldn't quite know how to deal with. And he asked his servant to go and investigate. And he says, tell me what this lady wants. And the servant said, she wants nothing. They have everything they want. They are blessed in every way. But there must be something. Something that she needs that only God could give. And the servant said, well, she doesn't have a child. She doesn't have a child. So immediately, the prophet is moved, and he calls the woman, and he says, this time next year, when I come past here again, there will be a little child on your knee. He will be weaned. So if you think about this, here was a little child who was going to be moving about, promised to this lady. She hadn't got pregnant even yet. And yet the prophet was saying, when he comes back in a year's time, this child's going to be scurrying about the place. Obviously not walking, he's less than a year. But crawling. So the woman was overjoyed when it came to pass and the prophet came and she had a little son. And I mean, her garden was full. You know, everything was perfect. The child lived for quite some time, grew, prospered, and got to the stage where he was able to go out into with his father out into the fields to do some of the work. Now, we don't know what age he was, but given the text, and the text, by the way, is 2 Kings 4 and the verses, I assume, would be running from about 1 right up to about 35, 36. But 2 Kings 4, if you want to just keep an eye on it. The problem was that one day when he was out with his father, the child took ill. The father ordered that the child be brought immediately back to his mother, and the mother nursed the child. She held him close to her. She nursed him. She gave him water. She did all she could, but the child died. Simple as that. The child simply died. Out of the blue. Now, I want to tell you what this woman did. She took the child. She put him up into the room. It was really just a room that they'd made for the prophet, not a full house like. It was a room. She went to his room, she laid him on the prophet's bed. She went out, she ordered the servants to get her the donkey, make it ready for a journey, and she went to go to Shiloh, was where the prophet was supposed to be. The husband saw her leaving and said to her, is everything all right? Where are you going? And she said, it's okay. I have to go to Shiloh, but everything's fine. Notice what she said. Everything's fine. So he didn't question her. He let her go on about her business. He wondered why she was going. It wasn't a high day. It wasn't a holy day. It wasn't a Sabbath. It confused him, but he didn't argue. She was the wife. And guess what happened? She got to Shiloh. The prophet saw her coming. Elisha says to his servant, isn't that the Shunammite woman? I wonder what she's doing here. Go down and find out if everything's all right with her and the family. So the prophet goes down, or the servant goes down, and he says to the lady, is everything all right? My master's asked to find out if everything's okay. Everything's fine. No problems at all. Need to speak to the prophet. So she comes and she says to the prophet, why did you lie to me? Why would you bring such a disaster upon me as to break my heart? Why did my son die? The prophet goes, What? What do you mean dead? God never told me anything about this child dying. If God hasn't told me this child's dying, this child cannot die. So he calls his servant. He says, take my staff, go and lay it on the child immediately. So the servant runs ahead, leaves this staff on the child, comes back, meets the prophet and the woman, still walking towards the house, and says, I've done what you said, no difference. Everything's exactly as it was, the child's still dead. Prophet comes in, goes up to the house. He lays himself on top of the child exactly the same way as Elijah had told him he had done it in Zarephath. Every single thing exactly, bit by bit. He calls to God, he refuses to accept it, and he does it until the child sneezes 7 times. 7 times! I guess when you sneeze, you're alive. Because he lifted him up, he took him out, gave him back to his mother, and that child lived, we believe, because the Bible doesn't tell us otherwise, into old age. Why did God allow the child to die? The lady had great faith, and she knew that when God had promised something, she would never lose that thing again. It was hers. She understood that. Yet the child had died. But look at her faith. Look at how she approached it. Everything's all right. It's going to be fine. She knew her child was lying up in the prophet's bed, cold, dead, still, lifeless. But she was not willing to accept it. All she had to do was get to the prophet, and he would arrange for God to restore her son to her. That's all she had to do, get to the prophet. That was her priority. That was all she did. There's two incidents, what people call resurrection, but it's not truly resurrection because, as I said, it's a restoration of life. Reviving them. Resuscitating them, I suppose, is a good word we could use. There is a third story I want to tell you. How can I bring this to you? Right. Elisha, I told you before, had this thing where he had two double portion. So everyone was expecting that there would be another miracle operated out of Elisha's life, because it was said there would be a certain number of miracles that he would perform in his lifetime. But he fell short of one before he died. And so everybody thought, don't know what that was all about. I mean, thought I would have done more. This is 2 Kings 13 verse 21. I'm going to read a bit of the background story for, well, I'm going to tell you a bit of background story. At that particular time in Israel, there was groups of individuals who would come into the land and they would steal and rob people and take away animals and cause destruction, a bit like there is today, I suppose, in those parts of the world. And the people were terrified. And it so happened in one small town that a man died and his friends needed to go and bury him. So they wrapped up the body loosely and they took the body with them out of the city to go and bury him. On the way there, they spotted a band of robbers. And they said, we got to get back to the city. But what we do when we're here? I know. There's a tomb round here. Let's open the tomb and put it in there. And if necessary, we can come back later and sort things out. So they opened the tomb. And this is what you have to understand. Threw the body in. And then scarpered. They're on their way back to the city. Back to the town. They're quite happy to be getting back before something happens to them. When suddenly somebody passes them. Running faster than they are. And they hadn't a clue. And yes, they were right. The dead man had just passed them running back to the town. How are you alive? I don't know, but as soon as I hit the ground when I was thrown in there, life just came back into me and I looked up and I saw them boys coming and I moved. I don't think it had the Irish accent. Needless to say, when the enemies had moved away, they went to investigate. And they discovered that the tomb that the individuals had opened was Elisha's. And the last miracle was performed by someone being restored to life when they touched his dead bones. It's a wonderful story, and there is an amusing aspect to it, and we can really enjoy that bit of it. But we've got to remember, these are stories in the Old Testament that remind us that God has the power over life and death. But listen, I told you there's a difference between resuscitation of the dead and resurrection. And the Bible tells us that in ancient times, people believed in resurrection. You'll not find the word resurrection in the Old Testament at all. What you will find is references to what they believed. In Isaiah 25 verse 7, there is a statement, the Lord will swallow up death forever. If you're going to swallow up death forever, you have to understand what that means. It means death's not going to exist anymore. And the only place we find that today is throughout the New Testament, when we're talking about Jesus and the ultimate end of death. But here was Isaiah the prophet in the Old Testament telling the people, the Lord will swallow up death forever. Again, it's Isaiah that we turn to for many of these verses about resurrection. In chapter 26, verse 19, he reads, Thy dead men shall live, together with my dead body shall they arise, awake, and sing, ye that dwell in dust. For thy dew is as the dew of the herbs, and the earth shall cast out her dead. Do we understand even what he meant when he was saying these things? He did. He knew there was a time when people who are to be buried and forgot about would restore to life. They would rejoice before God, and they would come up and they would sing to him, glorifying him, awakening. Daniel 12 verse 2 reminds us that many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake. Some to everlasting life, but some to reproaches and everlasting shame. That's Daniel 12 verse 2. I'm not going to go through all of these, honest. If I do, we'll be here all night. But I do want to share some with you. Job 19 verse 25 to 27. Though after my skin worms destroy this body, yet in my flesh shall I see God, whom I shall see for myself, and not another, through my reins be consumed within me. Old English is a bit awkward at times, but if you get the general drift of that, he's saying, look, I know I'm going to die. I know I'm going to decay. I know that this body's going to waste away. But I also know that God has promised that it is in this body, this man shall stand before God and give account of himself. That's what he knew. He knew about a resurrection. He understood about the thing. In Hosea 13, verse 14, it reads, I will ransom them from the power of the grave. I will redeem them from death. O death, I will be your plagues. O grave, I will be your destruction. Repentance shall be hid from thine eyes. We know that is a different statement, don't we? Death, where is thy sting? Grave, where is thy victory? We understand that as we read through these things, all of this was referred to. Because we have seen the resurrection occur. Oh, I know, we haven't experienced it yet. We're still here in the flesh. All our predecessors, all our ancestors in the faith, are still waiting for the event. But the resurrection is no longer a promise or hoped for event. It's a reality. The first earnest of it has taken place. You know, when a person's building a house, after they've got all their planning and all the rest done, everything's been discussed, and they've got the architect in and all the rest, people begin to realize that they're serious when they break soil and lay a foundation. It's not right. You know there's going to be a building. But you don't start the building on the foundation an hour or two after you lay the foundation. You let it settle. You give it a bit of time to ensure that everything's right, that everything has settled again before you start building. If you build too quickly, and we do know what happens from time to time, you're going to end up with subsidence and large cracks running up the walls of your house. As we drive around the country, we can see that from time to time. All of this is because the foundation wasn't allowed time to settle. But when you have the foundation, you have the proof that the house will be built. I know we're down our way. We have one particular foundation that has been sitting there for 15 years. I think that's a wee bit excessive. But generally speaking, that person, I'm sure, at some point will build a house. Our foundation is Jesus Christ. He is the firstborn of the sons of God. He is God's only begotten Son, begotten of the Father. Jesus Christ lived his life exactly as we do, in the flesh. He ate, he drank, he dressed, he enjoyed the sun in the morning, he enjoyed it, the rain hitting his face on the warm evening, he hid out of the heavy cloud the heavy storms that would blow, and covered himself away from them, same as we would. He heated himself by fire. He drank water to quench his thirst. Every single thing you do, he did, including die. Jesus experienced and tasted, as the Son of God, death directly for you. He wanted you to understand that he loved you enough that he was willing to experience what you must experience. At some point, you will die. And he wanted you to know that he would share even that tragedy with you. I was reading a commentary made comparing the death of Plato, or was it Aristotle? I'm never sure which one's which. The one that poisoned himself. I think it was Plato. Was it Plato? I'll ask my expert later. And the death of Jesus Christ. The difference between the two is startling. One, the Greek philosopher, we'll call him that way we're safe, determined that death was not something to be afraid of. Death was a welcome because it released the inner man. It allowed you to achieve your true potential. It freed you from the bonds of this earth and from the prison of your flesh. Jesus was terrified. He wept and sweated drops of blood. He cried out to his Father, "Remove this cup from me." He trembled at the very thought of facing death. Why? Why such a difference? See, Jesus knew what death really is. The philosopher didn't. He had disguised in his own mind the reasons. So he was happy to embrace death. But Jesus knew exactly what death was. Death is the absence of life. And God is life. God is love. God is joy. God is the fullness of all things. Death is the absence of everything that is God. Death is God's enemy. He didn't bring it into existence. It came into existence because of Adam's sin. Death and decay and destruction entered this earth because of Adam and Eve. But they didn't do it on purpose. They were deceived. So the true enemy to man is that deceiver who was identified as Satan, the devil. Jesus was terrified of death, but because he loved you, he faced it. He died. Sometimes we don't really understand the fact that when Jesus actually dies, he no longer existed. You see, this causes problems. You say, but hold on, he was God. God never ends. But you miss the point. Jesus died. That was the point. He died. He separated the same way as you'll be separated. He had no understanding in the grave, no understanding of what was going on. He experienced the full horror of death. Because he relied on God's promise of the resurrection. And he became the first fruit of all. But look at Jesus, look at him. When he resurrected from the grave, when he stood there in the house with the disciples, on that, was it even a Sunday evening? I think it was a Sunday evening, which would have been second day of the week, by the way. Sunday evening. He appeared among them. They had just got witnesses. They had just got the brethren who had just come all the way from this, from the wee town they'd been. It's just skipped my mind at the moment. It'll come back to me. They had walked with him. He had told them all about what it was. They had shared bread and then they'd recognised who he was. And now they were back and they were saying, but we saw him with our eyes, we talked to him, we shared bread with him, and therefore we know that he has risen. And as the disciples were about to dismiss them, Jesus said, hello. The Bible doesn't say he said hello, by the way. But you know, that's exactly what he said. Hello, looking for me? And they were terrified. Why? Well, you've just met a dead man. This is something that we don't fully grasp. The fact that the disciples knew Jesus was dead. Why did they know he was dead? They knew how efficient the cross was. They knew exactly what he suffered. They knew that when his body was put into that tomb, it had been necessary for Joseph of Arimathea and another name of the spirit, Nicodemus, to prepare the body of Jesus quickly, because the Sanhedrin had said, he has claimed that he will resurrect or come back to life. They didn't realize he was going to actually resurrect. They thought he was going to be returned to life, possibly, in 3 days. Therefore, as soon as the Sabbath's over, we're going to seal the tomb so that nobody can take him. As soon as the Sabbath's over. So they knew they had only the few hours before the Sabbath to make ready Jesus' body. And we're told exactly how they did that. Linen cloths wrapped up with spice to such a degree that the body is completely concocted. He wasn't going anywhere. But there was a reason for doing this. And I'll explain the reason. You'll not find it in the Bible, but I'll explain the reason. And it was referred to in previous sermons. Bible A, actually. So we're going to bring this up. After a person dies who is found guilty of crimes of blasphemy and can be proven that they did blaspheme, it was a common practice to not give them a burial but to burn the body. Here's the fun bit. While the charges against Jesus were that he blasphemed, until he didn't resurrect in 3 days, as he had said, the proof that he wasn't the Son of God couldn't be proven. The Sanhedrin, therefore, had to wait. So they knew that if they sealed the tomb, nice and gently sealed the tomb, came back 4 days later, and made a big announcement to the people, not only did the man blaspheme, but he said he'd be resurrected again in 3 days, and here's his body. And they would have taken the body from the tomb, they would have taken it to Gehenna, the rubbish dump in Jerusalem, and publicly threw him in. That was their intention. That was what they were going to think about doing. But Joseph and Nicodemus, who were aware, remember they were members of the Sanhedrin, had hoped that if they had prepared the body, if they could have left the body in its prepared state, then at least the body wouldn't have been burned, because that would have been considered sacrilege by the Jews. All of this was very tightly tied down. But here's the fun. The Jews came with Roman guards, sealed the stone, and Jesus still resurrected. Because what they didn't expect, what turned out to be the most powerful event in human history, was that God's promise of resurrection was not just to bring the dead person back to life, but to give them a completely new body that would not ever die again. Jesus Christ is the first of all who are to be resurrected. And you, sitting here today, are the ones who are to be next resurrected. You will join Abel, Abraham, Moses, all the apostles, and everyone else who has accepted the truth that God has been teaching throughout the years. You will be with Christ at his return. You will go and meet him in the air. All of this we have promised. All of this will happen. The reality of the situation is, in 1 Thessalonians 4:13 to 17, Paul, writing to the people, because they had no understanding of what was going on, said, "I do not want you uninformed, brothers, about those who are asleep, that you may not be grieved as others who have no hope. For since we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so, through Jesus, God will bring with him those who have fallen asleep. For this we declare to you by a word from the Lord, that we who are alive, who are left until the coming of the Lord, will not precede those who have fallen asleep. For the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a cry of command, with the voice of an archangel, with the voice of the trumpet of God, and the dead in Christ will rise first. Then we who are alive, who are left, will be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. And so we will always be with the Lord." That's the promise we have through Jesus Christ. It was the promise that the people, right back from Adam and Eve, through the promise of the seed that would come from the woman, was given. Right back then, they understood that death was going to be defeated, and death will be defeated through the resurrection. All man, woman, and child who has ever lived will suffer death, and all man, woman, and child who have ever lived will also face a resurrection. Those who are to be resurrected at Christ's coming are called blessed, for they shall never see death. The second death has no call on them. Those who arise after that in a resurrection of judgment will be judged. Some will go to glory. In that sense, they will be accepted into the kingdom. Their bodies will change just as our bodies will change, and they will be part of the kingdom forever. Others will go to everlasting destruction. They will face the second death. And from that, there is no resurrection. Thank you.